This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Today we're going to be talking about Tom Petty. There's a new box set that came out on September 28th. It's called An American Treasure, and it collects 60 songs from Tom Petty's catalog. And what's interesting about this box set is that there really aren't any of the hits that you associate with Tom Petty, like Free Fallin', American Girl, The Waiting, Don't Come Around Here No More. None of those songs are on this box set. And the hits that are on the box set, they're represented in different ways. Like there's a live track of I Won't Back Down. There's a live track of Even the Losers. There's alternate versions of some of those big songs. But for the most part, this box set looks at the less traveled parts of the Tom Petty discography. There's B-sides. There's like lots of live tracks. There's deep cuts from lesser-known albums. There's a lot of unreleased songs, including a lot of really great unreleased songs. If you're a Tom Petty fan, I think this box set has a lot to offer. It's not just going to reiterate the music that you already know, and it's actually going to spotlight some music that you might not be as familiar with or that you've never heard at all. I also think that if you've never listened to Tom Petty, that this is also a good introduction, because even if you've never really listened to Tom Petty, you've no doubt heard the big songs. You know, we've all heard American Girl a million times. Anytime you go to a stadium or the grocery store or wherever. And as great as that song is, when you only hear the same songs by a great artist all the time, it can kind of freeze that artist in ember and make them not seem as vital as they really are. And it seems like in the time since Tom Petty died that there's been an effort to sort of broaden the horizons with his music. The fact that the same songs were always played on classic rock radio, or the fact that Petty himself kind of flogged the same songs all the time when he was on tour with the Heartbreakers, it's kind of left this big catalog of music that hasn't really been explored very much. You know, and that's something that I'm excited to explore and also talk about with my guest for this week's episode, and that is Steve Kandel. He's a person that you might know from many, many different places. He's written for pretty much every music publication under the sun, places like Pitchfork, Spin, BuzzFeed, all types of places. And he's also a big Tom Petty fan, and we had a great time, you know, talking about Petty's catalog, as well as a phenomenon that I find really fascinating, which is how does death impact how we look at our biggest musical icons. You know, we've experienced this over and over in recent years where, you know, people like Tom Petty and David Bowie and Prince and Aretha Franklin and Leonard Cohen and all the way down the line, they've passed away, and it sort of led people to reassess their connection to these artists. And as beloved as these artists are, something inevitably happens after they die where we start to think of them in sort of an elevated way. You know, and in a lot of ways, any kind of critical perspective that we have on these artists goes away as well. And I've noticed that with me and Tom Petty, that as much as I loved him before he died, I'm sort of at the point now like where if I hear any Tom Petty song, even a Tom Petty song that I don't really feel like I like, I find myself enjoying it. You know, like my love for him has grown deeper in the past year. And I'm just really intrigued by that phenomenon. You know, what is it about death that enriches our experience with the artists that we've lost in recent years? You know, is that just sentimentality, you know, or is it something else? Is there something maybe that makes us see how we took these people for granted while they were alive? That's another thing that I explored with Steve. So this is a really great conversation, and I think you're all going to enjoy it. But before we get to that, I want to tell you about our sponsor for this week's episode, and it's our old friends at Harry's. Now, if you are a person that needs to shave all the time, like I do, I got to shave pretty much every other day, you know that buying razors is a hassle. You have to go to the store. You got to pay all this money. It takes a lot of time. And who has time to buy razors? Well, if you are in this kind of predicament, I have the deal for you. And I have a deal just for you, my Celebration Rock listeners. What you want to do is you want to go to harrys.com/rock. And you want to sign up for this trial offer. Now, what are you going to get in this trial offer? Well, you're going to get a weighted ergonomic handle. the five-blade razor with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, the rich lathering shave gel, and, of course, the travel blade cover, a favorite of Derek Madden, Celebration Rock pod producer.
I'm going out of town next week. I'm going to get all over that travel blade cover.
So, again, you want to go to harrys.com/rock. You want to sign up for this trial offer. You're going to get a great set of razors, and you're also going to help out the podcast. So thank you for doing that. Again, go to harrys.com/rock. Again, that's harrys.com/rock to redeem your offer. Okay. So me and Steve Kandel, we got into it about Tom Petty. We talked about An American Treasure, the new box set. And we also talked about just how, I guess, when our icons go away, why do we appreciate them more? You know, we had a really good conversation about that. And why don't we get to it? Here's me and Steve Kandel on the Celebration Rock podcast. Well, let's begin with this. You know, one thing I've been intrigued by lately, and this is true of Tom Petty, but it's true of all of the musical icons that have passed on in the last, you know, several years. Mm-hmm. It's a phenomenon that I don't think is unique. It seems sort of intuitive, but I think it's interesting. And it's this idea that, like, when someone dies and we listen to that person's music, that in some way it sounds different. And some ways it sounds better or more profound, or we approach it differently. And, you know, we see this in the short term, of course, when someone dies, usually there's a big rush on people buying the music or streaming the music. You know, normally a bunch of albums by that person will re-enter the top 10 for the week. That's a common thing. And then in the long term, I think it's pretty common to see a reevaluation of the artist's work that kind of goes on in the years after that. I think that happened with Bowie. I think it happened with Prince to a degree. You know, I thought it was interesting when Pitchfork did their top 100 albums of the 80s and Purple Rain was number one. And of course, Purple Rain was already a great record. I'm sure it was already ranked high on the previous list that Pitchfork did. But I do wonder if Prince's recent death sort of pushed that over the line past Thriller or Born in the USA or Remain in Light or any of the other kind of big 80s records that people talk about with that.
Yeah, definitely. For sure. I mean, I read your piece this morning and it's great. I mean, I agree with so much of that too. And I think that is, you know, a totally natural thing. And the thing that you had mentioned about hitting run, you know, you get a 4.7 one day and then basically a few weeks later, if that thing, or a couple months later, if that thing had come out, it would have been like, look at what we just lost.
Right.
And, you know, I think that stuff is particularly true of people who've been around a long time and your opinions of them have been able to sort of stratify just because of, lack of having to really sort of think about it or be challenged. So, I mean, I think some of what you're talking about is just that, like, there hasn't been any other occasion to revisit or to recontextualize the way there is with something as, like, momentous as a death, you know?
I mean, is it that? I mean, because I also feel like, you know, there's obviously sentimentality that comes into play. I mean, you feel differently about someone after they're gone. You have warmer feelings for them naturally. You don't want to be as critical about them. I mean, I had this theory in my piece, and you referenced the piece I wrote for uprocks.com. Thank you very much for plugging me before I had to plug myself. But, you know, in that piece, I made reference to, like, Prince put out a studio record. I think it was called, like, Hit and Run Phase 2 that was reviewed in Pitchfork, like, 3 months before Prince died, and it got a 4.7. And I think the headline said something like, another underwhelming release from Prince, like, in the last, you know, 20 years. And that was true. Like, the last two decades of his career, for the most part, people didn't really care about the new records that he was putting out. And then he, you know, dies 3 months later and everyone starts talking about how Prince was the sort of the soundtrack of their life and how momentous it was for him. And I don't think those people are lying. I think that's actually true. Certainly there was a time where they probably listened to Prince all the time and or whoever. But I mean, the theory I had was that it's sort of a thing about supply and demand, that when you know that an artist is there and that there's always the chance that you can see them live or that they're going to make another record, that it does kind of cause you to maybe take them for granted or undervalue it a little bit. But then when they're gone and you know, okay, there's no more new albums, there's no more new shows, all we have is this body of work, I have to reinvestigate this. I'm going to listen to the records I didn't really pay attention to before because this is the only new music that I'm ever going to get from this artist. I mean, does that ring true for you? I mean, why else do you think that people sort of feel this way about fallen icons?
I mean, I think it's definitely true. I think, you know, I think I'm similar to you, and I'm surprised by the reaction I still have about Teddy. I actually catch myself, like, and throughout the course of any given day, like, stopping and thinking, like, holy shit, Tom Petty died. Like, that's fucking crazy. And, you know, and I think everyone has moments of that with, like, Prince or with Bowie, but I think the difference is there's always been occasion to evaluate their careers and talk about their images and talk about the things they've done. And they just, you know, have done the kinds of work that sort of lends itself to, like, thinking bigger thoughts about. One of the sort of great things about Petty, it was like, he was someone that he was just, this sounds like an insult, but he was just agreeable. Like, he put out songs that a lot of people liked, and they weren't like, well, but it was never like, what does he mean? Like, what is he going for here? And, you know, and maybe that made him sort of considered to be a different kind of artist. But I also think that, like, that's a much harder thing to do now. It's so hard to get, you know, large amounts of people to agree on anything. He was like, you know, maybe the last guy we could all just sort of agree on.
Well, and I think you hit on a great point there that, you know, I think the other thing with Prince and Bowie is that they each had their moments where they were, you know, sort of at the center of the zeitgeist, you know, where people were really looking at them as sort of the epitome of great glamorous artists. And as consistently great as Tom Petty was for a long time, he never really had that moment. He was never like the guy. Like, if you want to make a sports analogy, you know, he was never Steph Curry, or he was never LeBron James. He was always like who's like the third or fourth best basketball player, like, that you could say.
I think the modern analog for this that I've, you know, seen and heard and probably said myself, like, so many times is, like, Spoon. Like, what do you do with a band that's just really good for a long time, but there's not going to be some, like, zeitgeist moment? There's not going to be, you know, and in a way, it seems like, you know, you can get penalized just for, like, hitting, like, solid doubles and triples every time out, as if that's an easy thing to do. And I think that, like, you know, maybe latter Petty, maybe, like, a little bit less so, but I do think that, like, there's something to be said for the fact that, like, it's just easy to take for granted when not only it's always good, you know, like, there'll always be a hit, and there'll always go all of those. I mean, I think, you know, something you had said too, he was never really known as an album artist, but, you know, like, every album has a couple good songs, you know, there's always clinkers, but there's always, like, you know, he always did the work. There was, like, his like, second tier is probably, like, the strongest in rock, you know?
Oh, yeah,
it's
totally.
Not just, like, it's not, like, hits and filler. Like, he's got this whole, like, second tier of songs, or maybe we can get, this one maybe we can get into more later, that are, you know, not as heralded, but they're just, like, really good. And I just think the cumulative effect of that after, like, 40 years is that you just sort of feel like, okay, well, that's not something I really have to think about a whole lot, because it's just all, you know, it's there, and it's always been there, and it's always going to be there. And it's not necessarily subject to the peaks and valleys and the drama of, you know, something like Prince. It's tricky because, you know, those albums, you know, just sort of got put up on streaming a couple weeks ago, you know, for the first time ever. And, you know, that was something he famously didn't really want to do. And then it was sort of like, oh, wow, all these records are out. And then it's like, oh, right, like, a lot of these weren't that good, but you really don't want to, you really want to sort of strain to sort of, like, see, you know, it was just, like, batting average, he was just doing so much stuff, and the batting average in there maybe wasn't so great that it was easy to be like, okay, well, we can sit this one out, he'll have another one in a year and a half, where I think with, like, Petty, it was never quite the same high or quite the same low, which is kind of always, like, it was just kind of there, and it never felt like a drop off. It never felt like it was too prolific. It never felt like he was easy to tune out.
What I think is interesting about Petty to me is that, and this is something that I was talking about in my piece, in that when I, like, in the past, like, 12 months, basically in the period since he died, the thing I've noticed is that there isn't a Tom Petty song that I hear now that I don't love. I love everything that he does now.
Yeah.
And I never get sick of listening to him. Like, last night, after I wrote my piece, I listened to Tom Petty for, like, 2 hours after I got done working. Yeah. And I was drinking beer, and it was, like, a really awesome night. And it's interesting because, like, I think about I kind of question my own response to the music right now, and I wonder what exactly is influencing that. And I think the reason I'm wondering this about myself is that I wrote this book that came out earlier this year called Twilight of the Gods. Derek, that's a that's a plug.
Nicely done.
Yeah, thank you very much. And Tom Petty died during the course of me kind of working on like a later draft of that book. So I'd written a part in that book about Tom Petty, and there's a section in the book where I compare him to Bruce Springsteen, and I'm talking about how Bruce Springsteen kind of had this sort of perfectionism to him when he worked on his albums, and that he had this sort of unending desire to be great and to achieve greatness, you know, even to an obnoxious degree sometimes. And Tom Petty had more of a kind of a casual approach, I think, in a lot of ways to how he approached certainly making albums. Not to say that he didn't care, but at least compared to Springsteen, I think even when you listen to Petty, there's a very sort of engaging, endearing casualness that made his record sound so good on the radio. I mean, there's a lightness to his music that Springsteen's doesn't have, that he could never have even if he tried to have that. And I think there's a line in the book where I talk about how every album that he has 3 to 4 perfect songs, and the rest is very well played, very appealing sounding filler, basically. And I remember reading that after Petty died and feeling like maybe I should change that because it seemed now maybe overly critical or even snarky to talk about him that way. And then I realized that, I ended up keeping it the same because I trusted my opinion before he died more so than my opinion after he died. Like, I felt like in a way that was maybe a better critical assessment than how I feel now after he's gone. And I'm just wondering, you know, because to me, I just think that's a really kind of intriguing idea that, like, once maybe someone goes, our critical perspective on them sort of gets skewed and it's not as honest, maybe, because there's so many other things that come into play with these things.
It does. I mean, I think to some, I mean, I totally hear that. I think, you know, I've been listening to you know, honestly, for years straight, I've probably listened to more like Tom Petty than I have in the, you know, 10 years before that combined. And I have like a similar reaction. And, you know, with me, I think it's a little bit of like, it's not that like that stuff isn't really filler, you know, 3 or 4 songs, an album, and the rest is filler. You know, on an album that only has 9 songs, that's a really good percentage,
right?
You know, which a lot of his, you know, that's what a lot of his albums were. They weren't like these big sprawling things. So, I mean, I think what some of it is just a little bit of maybe guilt about not realizing how hard even that was to do. And it's sort of easy to sort of, you know, I think what you're saying is like, it feels casual and it's easier to sort of dismiss compared to like, you know, a capital W piece of work, like a Bruce Springsteen album, that, you know, I think it's just sort of easier to be like, oh yeah, he's just kind of doing his thing. But then I think what happens after someone dies and you sort of looking at like, it's not that you're necessarily liking the music more. I mean, yeah, you're going to be a little more sentimental about it, but I do think that it's pretty fair to sort of think that like, even that thing that was easy enough to dismiss, there is a realization that like, that is really, really hard thing to do. Because no one else has been able to do it.
Right.
So even like what you're talking about, like, oh, it's a little bit more casual. Like, there's something about the sort of alchemy of being that casual and being not like super prolific, but also never really going away. Like, there's never a Tom Petty comeback album. There was never his like first album in 9 years. You know, he's always been around. He did things with the band. He did things without the band, but he never disappeared. You know, so there wasn't that sort of like momentous occasion that there would be, even with like, you know, Springsteen actually has had moments like that, you know, even though there aren't like huge gaps in his discography necessarily, but there's always been some sort of hook in a way that there maybe, you know, wasn't with a Petty album, which made it feel like it wasn't an event the same way, or that it didn't feel as thought through the same way. But I think that, yeah, what comes through, like looking, you know, with hindsight after someone's died, is you realize and you appreciate like that's really hard to do, to just kind of always be making records and never really sucking. like over 40 years. Like, that is impossible to do. There's no like dark period. There's no like reclamation era. There's no return to form. It's just like, some records were definitely better than others for sure. But there was, but you know, how hard is that to just always be around and always be doing, you know, be doing something worthwhile? I think it's easy to take that for granted when it's around. And then when someone like, you know, is around doing that, then after the fact, you look at it and you go, shit, like, how did you do that? Because I didn't know. I mean, like a lot of these things you're talking about, a lot of these records, you know, there's things you would have really liked, but you didn't really know about at the time. And I'm the same way. This is stuff that like is really right up my alley, and I didn't even pay any attention to it. And if I didn't pay attention to it, who is going to pay attention to it? Because I'm kind of like, I'm like straight down the middle of like of who now, you know, a record like that is going to be made for. And if I'm not really paying attention, then a lot of people may not be. And I think that like there's just some of that like, huh, like this was like sitting right in front of me and I didn't really think twice about it because it's just that guy who's always around. And then you listen to it after the fact and I'm like, shit, like that's a lot of really good stuff that like was not really on my radar, and it totally could have been and it totally should have been. And it, you know, at the very least, there's this recognition that like that is an extremely hard thing to do.
Well, I think with Petty too,
I think the thing
with Petty too that's interesting, and this kind of leads into the box set that came out last Friday, American Treasure, which is that Petty, I think more than his contemporaries, is defined by his hits. You know, there's like a narrow body of work that everybody knows that has a ubiquity that I think even goes beyond like the biggest Springsteen songs or the biggest like Neil Young songs or like anyone that you would mention about being a contemporary to Tom Petty. He has about 12 to 16 songs that I think, if you've ever spent time in, you know, a major league ballpark or at a gas station or any kind of public setting, like you've heard these songs many, many times. And, you know, we could talk about Free Fallin', American Girl, The Waitin', The Waiting. I said The Waitin'. I don't know why I said The Waitin'. Don't Come Around Here No More. I Won't Back Down. All these songs.
Don't Come Around Here Anymore.
No, I got that one right. I'm just saying, because, you know, he's Southern, so I wanted to call it The Waitin'.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's this, you know, and people all know these songs. And like, you know, his greatest hits record, I think, is like 12 times platinum. It's by far the best-selling record that he's ever put out. I think Full Moon Fever is like 6 times platinum, and that's the next best-selling record. So he doesn't have like a Born in the USA, even like in his catalog, that sort of towers like a studio record that where the whole album is a touchstone for people. And, you know, I think on one hand, you could say that those hits have given Petty, you know, I mean, those are great songs. It's a great legacy. It really has kind of entrenched him into popular culture in a way that a lot of his peers aren't. But I think there's also another argument you could say, and I think these are probably equally true, that those hits, the focus on those hits, it sort of calcified him in a way where he is considered this musical comfort food, you know, that you don't really have to think about, that you just enjoy. It's like this music is in the atmosphere. And it's wonderful that that's true, but it also sort of discourages any sort of any further investigation into the catalog. And it just becomes about these songs that everyone knows, and it becomes a little boring, I think, in a way. I think it's what led a lot of people to kind of take him for granted, which is what is interesting about this box set, because there seems to be a concerted effort, along with trying to just kind of cash in, I guess, on his archives. I mean, you could look at it cynically that way, but it seems like artistically anyway with this box set, what they're trying to do is to kind of nudge people beyond those hits, because there aren't really any of the big songs on the box set. I mean, do you think that approach serves Petty well? Or are those great songs that we all know, are those the most important songs and maybe you don't need to dig in so deep?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think that this is something I think I said to you the other day, too. I think that Petty is like one of the rare artists where you can make the case that like his biggest hits are his best songs. I think with almost any artist, there's always going to be some sort of like sleeper, or someone's got something like, this is the real, like, this one's for the real heads. But like, who could possibly like make the argument that like American Girl and Breakdown and Refugee aren't like the best things he's done? I mean, it's just kind of true. I mean, you could pick other songs from those records and say like, well, those should have been the singles, and like, you know, I guess, but you're probably just being contrary for contrary's sake. I mean, those are like, you know, those are his best songs, and those are the songs that were, that he was like remembered for the most. And there's some like, that kind of makes sense. I think, I mean, something that I had said, you know, a little earlier was that he has one of the strongest like tier twos in rock history. And I think that like what the box set does and what you sort of see happening is like, okay, so what is the next level of songs that are going to start like taking their place in the pantheon? And like, you know, I mean, for me, the one song that like a long time ago I would have said like this should have been his biggest hit is like something like Even the Losers. And now I think that is kind of considered like one of his biggest hits, but I feel like it wasn't a long time ago. I feel like that's been sort of a slow creep towards the center for something like that. I mean, I may be wrong. I may be remembering it wrong, but no, I think that was always,
I think you're right.
Songs that was like considered like, oh yeah, well, you know, this is sure like, you know, Refugee, but this is, you know, Even the Loser is the real one, you know, and like, but I feel like that's at this point, I mean, that is the most, one of the most, probably the third most famous song on this box set, you know, like he did sort of really steer away from that, but like,
and it's a live version too, it's not the original studio version, I think it's like an acoustic version from sometime in the 80s.
No, I think, yeah, it comes up here as like being like one of like the requisite hits, you know, like it feels like it's already crossed over to the other side. I think that there's a whole other wave of other songs of his that have been kind of, they weren't sort of quite hits, or they weren't singles, but now they have a chance to sort of be elevated a little bit too. And I don't think,
well, one thing I think that's worth mentioning too is that like you and I think are around the same age. Like I'm 41 and you're like around 40, right?
Oh man, bless your heart.
Are you older than me?
I'm older than you. But.
Okay, so you're north of 41. So maybe because I know for me, like the first big Tom Petty record that I was like sort of alive to know about and care about was Full Moon Fever, and like the '90s Petty was like my Petty, and then I went back and I got all the 70s and 80s albums. So there is that sort of like two waves, I think, of Petty fandom, at least like if you were alive when the albums were coming out. So like Full Moon Fever has like such an outsized footprint, I think, on like how a lot of people know him. So like in a way, I guess for those people, like a song like Even the Losers is like a deep cut. Because you're used to like all the Full Moon Fever tracks and Into the Great Wide Open and Wildflowers, all those albums. And I know you're not a Full Moon Fever guy, right? You don't like that record?
Well, no. So I think it's, I'm not very much older than you, but I do think that there's a weird like generational thing, because I feel like for me, I'm old enough that I guess like Long After Dark and like Southern Accents were like really, really big deals for me, and that was where I sort of came in. And then like when Full Moon Fever came out, that was right when I was like old enough to be like contrary and be like, I actually don't like Full Moon Fever very much. And I didn't like the sounds of that. And like the Traveling Wilburys records of Jeff Lynne, like the really sort of big open drum set. It never kind of felt like right to me. Even though those are like, so it was weird that was never the touchstone for me. That was kind of the thing where it was like, okay, well, maybe this is something else now. I was never like mad at it, but that was never the way in. Whereas I think of, I would say like Long After, I think that's around 85. Yeah, I remember like Southern Accents being a really like big deal, and like Pack Up the Plantation and the live film of that. I remember that feeling like really formative to me, and those were just like, you know, kind of like a loose rock band, and whereas Full Moon Fever, you know, to me that felt like, I thought that that was like at the time like Teddy's like Human Touch, you know, like,
oh man,
I don't think history like proves me right, but I feel like at the time I probably grouped those in together, and I always separated like the songs from how they sounded. You'd always see those songs live and it'd be like, oh, I mean, no one's going to argue against, you know, Free Fallin' or Running Down a Dream as songs, but there's just something about the way they sounded. And I'm not really that guy about things, but for some reason, those always rubbed me the wrong way, just as like recordings, and but it just, I just mean kind of weirdly generationally, that wasn't, that was never the be all end all for me. I felt like Wildflowers is sort of like a, you know, a little bit like, you know, dialing it back a little bit, and I was back, you know, I never like went away, but it's just, yeah, there's different touchstones.
I just love that I found the one Tom Petty fan that isn't into Full Moon Fever. I mean, I think this is like an I know you're not the only one. I'm sure there's like lots of people that agree with that. Like, and I've heard the complaints about the Jeff Lynne production. I mean, it really kind of goes deep into the Great Wide Open. Like, that album is like super produced. I feel like Full Moon Fever is like a little more restrained than the Traveling Wilburys record and like Into the Great Wide Open. I mean, I love Into the Great Wide Open. I mean, but those were totally like my entry points into Tom Petty, and then, you know, Mary Jane's Last Dance and all that stuff. Derek, you're going to chime in.
I hope Full Moon Fever would be his rising, at least. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I think there's a kind of a, like a classic rock radio effect that almost like similar to the Eagles, where this format came along sort of in the middle of Tom Petty's career. And I think sort of changed the legacy of some of his earlier stuff versus what it might have been on contemporary radio. Whereas when Full Moon Fever came around, he was kind of this MTV star for a minute. Like if Tom Petty had a moment, it was certainly like that era.
Although he was always on MTV. I remember being 5 or 6 years old and seeing the video for You Got Lucky.
Yeah.
Made like Van Halen videos and Michael Jackson.
He was around. Yeah.
And Petty won a Video Vanguard Award.
For the Don't Come Around Here No More, is it?
No, that's like the career award. Right. You know? So it's like, you know.
But Don't Come Around Here No More was like his sledgehammer. That was the one that made him like an MTV. Although You Got Lucky probably a little bit.
I always loved the You Got Lucky video. Like the Mad Max video. I thought that was awesome. And like Running Down the Dream, Running Down a Dream had the like animation thing going on in that video. I remember that being like well regarded. I mean, Petty, like,
into the Great Wide Open had Johnny Depp.
I mean, that's the thing, like,
get more Video Vanguard than that.
Like, one thing, you know, and I wrote about this in the book, but like Petty's videos were he actually gave a shit about his videos in a way that like Bruce Springsteen didn't. Like, Bruce Springsteen's videos like are generally like pretty shitty, even though he was working like with great directors a lot of the time. But like Petty like made good music videos, like in a way that you wouldn't expect a guy like that to care. And I'm sure like he would never admit to that, but the videos were too good for him not to have some knowledge of that. I mean, I think he actually cared about having good music videos.
No, I think he wanted to be a pop star. Like, there was never any sort of, you know, there was no real pretension in like, oh, I'm going to do, oh, I guess they're playing that on the radio. Fine. I mean, as far as I know about that, he was always trying to like get played on the radio, and he never rejected that. He never stopped playing his biggest hits because he was like bored of them. There was never any sort of backlash. That was something he always wanted. Like, he, you know, like, look at that guy. Like, you think he can believe his luck that he sort of came up and got to be someone who like got to be on camera and like filmed in these cool things all the time? I think he probably thought he was insanely lucky to even have the opportunity to be someone who might win a Video Vanguard. And he never turned up his nose at that. He never turned up his nose at the idea of trying to be popular and trying to have hits. You know, there was never, even like his sort of later era shows when he was doing, you know, it was more like a jam band kind of thing where he had like the Persian rug down and 3 hour shows or whatever, you know, like, He wanted pop hits, and he always wanted that, and he never rejected that. So in a way that even Springsteen, I feel like, would be a little squeamish about. Like, he sort of eventually kind of got there, but it always felt like, okay, fine, I guess I'm doing this now, you know. But like with Petty, that was always the point, you know.
Well, his run too, like of having hits, like from basically the late 70s until like really like the mid 90s, he was having songs that were big on MTV, that were big on certainly like rock radio at least. I mean, that's a pretty great run. I mean, I in terms of like American rock bands, I mean, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers have to be like the best singles band, like rivaling like CCR. I feel like CCR and the Beach Boys, like they're on that level of like a band that, like those, like, because like similar to those bands had great albums, but like we remember them primarily because of their singles. And like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, I think, have a similar legacy. In a way, they're kind of like the last great rock. I mean, maybe like the Foo Fighters kind of had that for a while, you know, at least on rock radio. They had a really good run. They kind of petered out a little bit.
I throw Aerosmith maybe in there as an American rock band that you remember for singles more than albums, really.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
I mean, I think the thing that's fascinating now is imagine someone coming out with songs that sound like Tom Petty's and being like, you know, the biggest hits in the world. You know, it seems so, you know, you can dismiss it in a way and be like, oh, it's just simple. It's like these, like, you know, radio friendly, like, you know, pop rock hits and like, you know, but it feels so impossible right now.
Well, country radio, you know? you could have country hits that sound like that. And that's why Tom Petty now has been adopted by.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, this sounds incredibly grumpy old man, but like, it's just crazy to me that something like what he does could be considered an anathema in any way, or could be considered, it just seems, so deceptively simple to do that kind of thing. Like, you know, and to now not appreciate the craft of being able to do those kinds of songs that could have, you know, such wide audiences, you know, like it would be absolutely impossible to replicate. And you could say that about so many artists' careers now, but like Tom Petty's career seems impossible to replicate. And even though you can take it for granted, and then this sort of tying back to what we were saying before about like, why do we, you know, why do we listen to this stuff differently and have a different kind of reaction now? It's because I do think there's that sense of like, that was really it. Like a big, heavy steel door shuts behind him, you know, and what he did, whether you're super passionate about it or like, oh yeah, I always liked that guy. You know, there is still that realization of what he did is not a thing that seems like possible in 2018. And it's easy to get a little wistful about that. And it's easy to get a little bit like, you know, how did he do that?
You know? I want to go back to something you said before about how great his second tier is, because I think that's a great point. It's similar to something I was going to bring up too, because, you know, before we were doing the pod, you know, Steve and I were talking about, like, I was saying, like, well, we should come up with lists of like our favorite deep cuts. And we were kind of debating like, what is a Tom Petty deep cut? And I was sort of saying like, well, anything on Full Moon Fever can't be a deep cut because that record is so ubiquitous. So that's like one definition. But I was going through this and he really does have these different tiers where you have the first tier, which are again, like your Free Fallins, your American Girls, you know, The Waiting or The Waitin', you know, if you want to be casual, you know, those 10, 12, 13, 15 songs that everyone knows. And then there's that second tier where they're not huge radio hits and maybe like super casual listeners don't know them, but like a song like You're So Bad or a song like The Wild One Forever or Straight Into Darkness, Rebels. You know, like, are those deep cuts? Like, yeah. Do they count as deep cuts? Like, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't hits. They weren't singles. I mean, I think it's the same thing I was saying about Even the Losers before. I think Even the Losers, like, I always used to think of that as a deep cut, in that it was never like a hit. But it's been around for long enough that I think it's considered, you know, a hit. But there's no paper trail. You know, I don't think it was ever released as a single. I mean, if you're being like that, if you're being from like a pretty like, you know, strict definition of like between a hit and not a hit, you know, then I think songs like that, like Straight Into Darkness, I would say Insider, you know, songs that have just Honeybee, I guess, songs that have sort of been around, you know, I think like songs that like if maybe they'd be the second song he'd play on SNL, not the first one,
right?
You know, like that kind of, or maybe that's not, maybe that's too generous but you know, things that are, they're not like buried treasure, you know. I will definitely grant that there are songs on that box set that like I didn't know, and I was just like, shit, like that's weird that I didn't know that song. But he's got a lot of that. I mean, there's a huge realm after those like 15 or so, you know, omnipresent ones that are just like as good as any of that. And like, I'm sure there's definitely a drop off between tier 2 and tier 3 maybe, but like, but There's a lot in there. Like, it's a Straight and Dark, as you had mentioned that, but that feels like the quintessential one. It was never a hit. I don't think it was ever like a radio, hit or anything like that. But every time you hear that, you're like, oh yeah, that thing's great.
And I feel like anyone that has any knowledge of Tom Petty knows that song,
Right.
Unless you only listen to him on the radio, you don't know that song. But I feel like most people, or like The Wild One Forever is another one where I feel like if you are at all a Tom Petty fan, you know that song. So I feel weird calling it a deep cut because I feel like anyone with any knowledge would say, well, that song's too well known.
That album was not like that first album was not a huge hit when it came out. Like Breakdown was like not really a single. And that was like not like it wasn't. I mean, people kind of came back to it, but like that wasn't. I don't know. Like I don't feel like that. I don't know.
I mean, like one thing that going back again to my book again, Twilight of the Gods. That's a plug, Derek. thank you. The expertly filled, the expertly played filler comment that I made in that book, which again, like when I wrote that, I wasn't trying to put him down. It was my way of sort of complimenting him because again, I feel like Tom Petty for me has always been this artist that I've loved sort of unconditionally, that I could just listen to any of his records and I would love it sort of instantly in sort of like a Pavlovian sense almost, without having to intellectualize it. And I've always loved that about his music, at least like, those big kind of red meat hits that he has. But one thing I've noticed as I've dug deeper into his catalog in the months after he died and, even before that, is that you really cannot underestimate the value of his band because there are a lot of Tom Petty songs that I think are merely good or just okay. And they sound amazing because Mike Campbell plays a great guitar solo at the end and Ben Montench is whipping out a piano solo or playing the organ on it. Like a song, you mentioned the song in passing a couple minutes ago, Honeybee, because that was a song on my list for like kind of less heralded songs that I love. And I don't know if that's a song, but it's a great performance. And just the way, and I mean, that's not technically a Heartbreakers record, but like a lot of the Heartbreakers play on that song. And, in particular, Mike Campbell. And just any excuse to hear him play a guitar solo, I'm kind of 75% of the way there, even if the song itself is just okay. And I always feel like Mike Campbell, especially because he co-wrote so many of the songs, is always like an underrated part of this story. Like we talk so much about Tom Petty, but those three guys, because he had those two lieutenants with him on pretty much everything he did, including the Mudcrutch stuff. I don't think you can underestimate the value that they add to his music.
And before they were, growing up, not growing up, but like they're literally every step. And I think about those guys a lot. Like, what is it? Like, what do you do? You wake up one day and like the person that you worked with so closely and that you have, that you sort of tied your entire musical identity to. I mean, they were more of a band than a lot of bands. And it's like, it's his name up top above the title, but you can't really picture one without the other. And that feels, honestly more true to me than like, if we're using the Springsteen comparison, Campbell feels more like tied to that than like any one person in Springsteen's
orbit,
I feel like.
I totally agree. I mean, in terms of like the songwriting and like the actual construction of the records, like there's no one in the E Street Band that is as important as Mike Campbell is, and Ben Montage.
And I've thought a lot about too, like Mike Campbell.
I have a $1 million idea for the Heartbreakers. I think because I would pay to see the Heartbreakers play. I still want to see them play. I think what they should do is get like three or four singer-songwriter people that, or maybe it's like a revolving cast, and you just have them sort of sub in for Petty, and like it's like a revolving thing, almost like The Last Waltz, but instead of the band, it'd be the Heartbreakers, and just have them do a tour that way. So like,
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean,
like get Ryan Adams, Conor Oberst, like I know people like that in that vein, like Jenny Lewis, just get like an all-star cast of people and have the Heartbreakers back them up. I think that would be an awesome tour. I don't know how you organize that, But I think that would be really cool to see.
Or as a couple one-offs. I mean, yeah. I thought a lot about how, like, Mike Campbell is in, like, Fleetwood Mac now, and how he just must be, like, you just don't know what to do, so you just want to, like, just put me somewhere where I can play, like, guitar solos on songs I know, you know, like, and how, but don't let me sit home, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I just sort of have, I've not heard him speak to this at all, but, like, I just sort of feel like, what do these guys do when they wake up that day after? And like, what do we do? Where do we go? You know, it was never the kind of thing. I mean, I know that Mike Campbell, I'm sure he did stuff outside of Petty, but it's not like he had this other thing that was his like real outlet. But then I'm going to help this guy. Like it was just, you know, that was his life too. And what do you do with that when it's gone, like, you know, that suddenly? And that's, like, I have so much sympathy for that. And I think that it's so hard to understand. And I think a lot about, I hope this isn't too much of, like, a tangent, but I think about this, like, man, I talk about this story all the time, but this profile that Zach Baron wrote a couple of years ago of Adam Horowitz. And it was just, like, and he was just like, I don't know what to do. This has been my entire life. You know, my best friend died. My best friend is the guy I made all this music with. You know, I had no plan B. I was like wealthy while very young. I don't know what to do all day, you know? And it's not something you think about at the time. I mean, I don't think that I don't know if their situations are exactly the same, in terms of like the suddenness, but I just think that it, like, when you're so tied to something and you just don't think about what you're going to do when that goes away. And I think about, like, you know, Mike Campbell and Ben Montench and just how, you know, just how strange that must be.
Well, Adam Horowitz should also join Fleetwood Mac. That would solve that problem. No,
Or the Heartbreakers.
Well, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, I mean, I saw a quote recently where Mike Campbell said, like, we are going to play together again about the Heartbreakers. So I think that they've probably already talked about doing something. And mm-hmm. I'm telling you guys, and I know Mike and Ben Mott listen to this podcast, or hopefully someone will play them this podcast. Take my idea. I think that's a good idea. I think you should do some sort of last waltz tour with a bunch of other, like, people. Maybe you play Petty songs. Maybe there's other things you can do. But you're a great band. There's tons of people that would want to be backed up by the Heartbreakers. So do that. That's my idea for them.
That's a good idea.
So I've been wondering, before I let you go here, is there like one, like, you know, lesser known Tom Petty song that you would say, check this one out, like, this is an underrated track, you know, don't listen to American Girl again, listen to this song at least once?
I mean, now I feel like I'm going to be, because, you know, it used to be Even the Losers, and then it, like, the past couple of years, it's been Straight in the Darkness, but I feel like you would say that doesn't count, because that's not deep enough. I would say, like, the record that I find myself going back to, it's not any particular song, but, like Highway Companion feels like there's good stuff on there, and I feel like at the time it was kind of like, okay, here's another one, and then, and I feel like even with all the Petty records after that, they were like, okay, like, I don't think that, like, Hypnotic Eye and Mojo, like, I don't think those did that much for me. But I remember thinking, like there's a few different ones on Highway Companion that were like, these feel like they could be, excuse me, they feel like they could be, like, right in there. And
Down South is on that record. That's a great song.
Down South, and that's on the box set too. And I was, for sure, you know, it was weird. I hadn't thought about that, and I was like, oh, that's where that's from. But I remember, like, when that came out, thinking, like, this is a great, like, really interesting song, and it didn't really quite, you know, go anywhere. I don't know, maybe that's not the right way to say it. Not didn't go anywhere, but it just didn't have that same kind of. Like Saving Grace, I think was like the single or the hit from that album, and that's like still also like really, really good. I should have been prepared for this.
And Highway Companion, produced by Jeff Lynne, so you even came around on Jeff Lynne at the end.
I did, but it didn't have that same kind of, like, you know,
it's more stripped back,
cavernous kind of sound to me. I'm honestly not like a sonic snob at all. I think that, like, if anything, like, those dives into the Great Wide Open and the Wilbury record are probably the only record I've ever been like that about.
Right. They're pretty overblown. But I love those records. I mean, like, one thing I was going to say, like, for me, like, the sort of underrated one would be probably from Let Me Up, I've Had Enough from 1987, because that's like the one Tom Petty record, like, from his glory years anyway, that I just could not get into. Like, I love all of his other 80s records.
Would Runaway Train count, or is that too much?
Well, I was going to say, it's funny you say that, because that was the song I was going to mention off of that record. I mean, that whole record to me, it's interesting too. I mean, this is how, you know, different trends sometimes affect how older music sounds, because now when I listen to that record, because, like, before when I would listen to Let Me Up, I've Had Enough, it just sounded like so 80s to me in a way. I guess, I mean, Southern Accents has some of that problem too, but like Long After Dark and Hard Promises, I always loved those records, but Let Me Up, I've Had Enough, I just couldn't get into. But now, like, a song like Runaway Trains, I mean, it sounds like, you know, the rough draft of The War on Drugs, like, when I listen to that song. Like, a lot of the, there's like very kind of synthy sounding rock songs on that record. And so it's really interesting to kind of revisit it through that lens now. And Runaway Trains, I think, is a great song.
I would say the song Let Me Up, I've Had Enough was always great. And that actually holds up. That does not feel quite as like 1987 or 1980. That really holds up as being a pretty like straightforward. So that would be on the short list.
Well, so Steve, I feel like I could talk about Tom Petty with you for a long time here, but I think I've kept you longer than I said I would. So I'm gonna let you go.
Okay.
This was so fun talking with you. I hope that
thanks, man.
We can have you on again sometime.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know we had one idea that we were talking about a while ago.
So there is an idea that's been floated. So that might be the show that gets Steve the friend of the pod status.
All I've ever wanted is to be a friend of someone's pod.
All right, Steve. Well, hey, man. Thanks again, man. Take care. All right. So that was me and Steve talking about Tom Petty. I love talking about Tom Petty. I love writing about Tom Petty. And I don't know, maybe we'll do him again sometime. You know, we always do these series on artists. I don't know if we have to do a deep dive on Tom Petty at some point.
Yeah, he'd be a good one.
He'd be a good topic. Thank you again, everyone, for listening to this week's episode. We would not be here without our Celebration Rock Pod listeners, so thank you for your support. Also got to give a shout-out to Derek Madden, the man who makes it happen. Thank you, Derek, for being the producer. And thank you, Josh Copperman, for writing our theme song. Josh, thank you so much. Guys, we will be back again next week with more Celebration Rock. Until then, take it easy.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draftaccess to register for free entry today.